Hi.
Hi.
Sorry for the inaccurate designation. I didn't get a chance to change that. That was the last time I gave this presentation. And I've heard complaints that the blurb was not very clear, or that people found it confusing. So I apologize for that. I'll try to be a bit more clear in person. But this is a somewhat abstract or slightly more abstract presentation, in which I try to get into a bit more depth about this idea of prefigurative politics, about being the change. And what I want to do here is two major things. The first is to kind of have a look at the anarchist roots of the notion that a revolutionary movement needs to anticipate the society that it seeks, and to contextualize that primarily in the struggle within the workers' movement between anarchism and authoritarian forms of Marxism. The second aspect, which is perhaps a bit more controversial, is a look at the what some philosophers like to call the genealogy, roots, the historical roots, maybe, of the idea of prefiguration. And because, you know, I find that a lot of activists, including myself, use the term prefigurative politics quite freely. But I was always curious about its sources, so I went and kind of tried to dig them up. And the further I went backwards, the more problematic I felt the term was, or at least some of the possible associations of it. And so really this is an invitation to question the frame of mind that we bring into our efforts as participants in movements, and to question what could be one mentality, which I think is a bit problematic around this. Okay? So let me just begin with this concept of prefigurative politics, something that, you know, tends to be used quite often in anarchist and allied movements, and see where that actually comes from. But my argument later on will be that there is really a contradiction between the anarchist practices that we normally associate with the idea of prefigurative politics and what I'll call here the logic of prefiguration, which is a temporal logic, and is a logic that is a logic to do with time. And it's a logic whereby a future anarchist society somehow radiates backwards on the present. And I think there's a contradiction between these two notions, which kind of leaves contemporary anarchists kind of stretched between between the preordained and the experimental, the certain and the contingent, or the kind of ephemeral and the concrete. And I'll end up arguing that this second aspect, this temporal logic of prefiguration, is a secularized theological concept which has its roots very distinctly in Christian theology, and which becomes secularized in its passage through Marxism. And so that there are a lot of reasons for anarchists to be reserved about their use of the concept, or at least about the mentality that they bring into it. Now, unlike the practices for which the term stands, the term prefigurative politics itself is not a term that emerged organically from activist movements. Instead, it's a term that was introduced by intellectuals. And what is usually mentioned as the source for the term is this book by Winnie Brains, who is a sociologist, which discusses community organization in the New Left. And here, Brains actually recalls an article that she published earlier on in a journal called Social Problems, both of which kind of try, I think quite successfully, to counter-argue against this kind of dismissal of the New Left as, you know, something that didn't have leaders, didn't have demands, didn't have a program for changing, for getting power or any of that. And what Brains argues is that this was that actually it had a different logic. It had this logic of creating counter institutions or creating new forms of life. And so she introduces the term prefigurative politics and defines it in this way. It designates an essentially anti-organizational politics, which she qualifies by meaning a lack of formal or membership organization, the attempt to embody personal and anti-hierarchical values to develop the seeds of liberation in the new society prior to and in the process of revolution through notions of participatory democracy grounded in counter-institutions, which she earlier this says are non-capitalist and communitarian. Now, in the paper, unlike in the book, Brains actually acknowledges an earlier source for the term prefigurative in a political context, which disappeared from the book, and so she is often credited with coining the term. But as I said, in the paper, she does acknowledge an earlier source, and this is an article by the Marxist scholar Karl Boggs called Marxism, Prefigurative Communism, and the Problem of Workers' Control. This was published in this decennial issue of Radical America. This was a magazine that was started in 1967 by Paul Buell and members of SDS, the Students for a Democratic Society, but kind of long outlived its seedbed to become a much kind of broader left publication without any kind of organizational affinities. And I'd like to draw attention to Boggs' definition here, because I mean, the way he speaks of prefiguration talks about the embodiment within the ongoing political practice of a movement of those forms of social relations, decision-making, culture, and human experience that are the ultimate goal. Now, let me just draw your attention to a difference between this and the previous definition. The previous definition specified substantive political content to this prefiguration. It talked about anti-hierarchical, non-commodified, communitarian, anti-capitalist forms. Okay? Boggs's definition, in contrast, is what we might call formal rather than substantive. It only emphasizes this correspondence of means and ends. And I'd like to begin with the point that there's actually nothing in this formal definition that necessitates the substantive definition. That is, there is a sense in which the idea of embodying the society you wish to create is trivial. And we can ask, who doesn't prefigure? So, you know, we can give examples of, let's say, on the top right, you can see, the example of legitimist movements. So, you know, these kind of movements that seek to restore a deposed monarch or one of their descendants to the throne. And these movements most often are structured as this kind of royal court in waiting, right, with the claimant as a figurehead and a group of loyal supporters occupying key positions in the campaign. If we look at campaigns of, you know, Bonnie Prince Charlie, Louis the 18th of France, Karl I of Austria was deposed in the First World War, and so on. What about neo-Nazi groups? Whether they are old-line Hitlerists like the American National Socialist Movement under Rockwell, who kind of practiced the Führer principle and so on, or it's kind of more decentralist, white nationalists who organize in informal networks and form these kind of pioneer Little Europe separatist intentional communities, right? So not only the kind of anarchists on the bottom right here are prefiguring. I mean, even most prosaically, what about, you know, just a political party that supports, you know, standard state democracy and has democratic elections in its own structures? I mean, aren't these just points, just valid forms of practicing what you preach? And so in order to understand what actually is significant about the anarchist emphasis on this, we need to look at the one group that actually doesn't do this, namely Marxist-Leninists. And you can see Zapata here on the side complaining about this. So, you know, this is the contextual significance and the relevance of the substantive definition that we get from Brains. The practices that are referred to as prefigurative politics are set in explicit opposition to the one major political tendency whose ends and means do not correspond, namely authoritarian Marxism, or Marxist-Leninism for that matter. And this is a tendency that posits as its end goal a stateless communist society, right? Pure communism, where people behave according to Lenin himself, without force, without compulsion, without subordination. This is in his The State and Revolution, a book that was published in 1917, and the closest he comes really to an anarchist position in terms of strategies as well. But on the other hand, their practice proceeds through these top-down authoritarian structures. And so the historically and politically specific context in which the emphasis of prefiguration receives its relevance is the contention between Marxism and anarchism. And interestingly here, Karl Boggs, who we just saw in Radical America, although he acknowledges that the prefigurative tradition begins with the 19th century anarchists, in fact passes over the anarchist contribution entirely in his article and only discusses the prefigurative nature of these council insurgencies in Russia, Italy, and Germany between 1917 and 1920. And so he rather dishonestly employs this kind of well-rehearsed litany of stereotypes to in the process, where, you know, he says that the anarchists and the anarcho-syndicalists, and I'm quoting, scorned politics. They showed contempt for theory and organization in any form and were basically romantic and utopian, looking to an idyllic past rooted in a primitive collectivism. All of this without, you know, shred of evidence, a single quote to substantiate it. These very standard Marxist stereotypes and caricatures of anarchism. And so what is more, having first commended prefiguration for viewing, you know, statism and authoritarianism as obstacles to be overturned, Boggs in his own article seems to recoil from the anarchist consequences of his own argument, and he refers almost immediately to prefigurative structures as a nucleus of a future socialist state, and condemning councilism as one of its faults commending councilism for not contemptuously dismissing the contestation for state power. And so I'd like then to rectify, first of all, this forgetting by looking at least two key moments in which anarchists have expressed the importance of the correspondence between means and ends. And the first of these was the wake of the Paris Commune. Bakunin, writing after the Commune, I mean, the anarchist stress on means and ends correspondence dates back to this kind of formative conflict between Marxist and anarchist, the breakup of the First International following the Paris Commune in 1871, a conflict that's kind of personified by Marx and Bakunin. And in the wake of the defeat of the Paris Commune and the kind of dilemmas in the international, Bakunin's main concern is to prevent a top-down organization of revolutionary work that would create new states. Right? So for him, the goal of the international should be to organize the masses only to facilitate the destruction of the state. And in his article, The Paris Commune and the Idea of the State, which is the introduction to the second part of his kind of major book, the Knuto-German Empire, the first part of which is known as Statism and Anarchy. He certainly commends both the kind of genius of spontaneous uprisings and creating new institutions and new ways of life that can never be planned in advance by any sages and scholars, and about the necessity to avoid seeding new forms of hierarchy and power in the revolutionary process itself. Okay, I won't read out the quote, you've probably already kind of scanned it. And this, I think, is, you know, an expression of the first among two sources, really, for anarchist support for anti-hierarchical organizing, what we might call the path dependency argument, which is basically to say that there is an inescapable choice between two ways of conducting social transformation in each of its stages, that is, the organization of the revolutionary movement, the form that revolution takes, and the kind of society that you get in the end. Right? So you can organize hierarchically, get a seizure of state power, and end up with the Soviet Union, essentially, or organize non-hierarchically, have a revolutionary model that does not involve seizure of state power, but it's abolition, and end up with an anarchist society. So there is a sort of a prophylactic or defensive role that the use of non-hierarchical means fulfills in this context. And I guess you all know the most eloquent expression of this logic by Emma Goldman, which follows exactly on the heels of the vindication of this, right? Emma Goldman, as I'm sure you know, was deported to Russia from the USA in the Red Scare, and she spent 2 years in the new Soviet state, and she has a very famous and lovely written memoir called My Disillusionment in Russia, which appeared in two parts at the time. It has My Further Disillusionment, but today it's easy to get in a single volume. And she documents, alongside the hardships and hopes of the period, also the opportunism of the Bolshevik leadership and the increasing suppression of the radicals and anarchists who opposed it. And this kind of statement from Goldman is probably the most famous, or certainly my favorite expression of the idea of correspondence between ends and means. I'll let you just have a look. I'm happy to kind of email people this PowerPoint if they're interested. There will be a final version of a written article as well at some point. So I'll let you just have a quick read. Now, alongside this concept of, by the way, all these kind of small caps are in the original. So the concept of transvaluation, I can't not comment on it. This is kind of one of the obvious indications of Goldman's affinity with Nietzsche. Right? This is a very kind of Nietzschean term, and Goldman was very influenced by Nietzsche. But what I'd like to draw your attention to, more importantly for our purpose, is her phrases towards the end: today is the parent of tomorrow, the present casts its shadow far into the future. And I'd like to emphasize that here there is no trace, really, of a kind of loop backward logic from a future state to the present. On the contrary, we're talking about this kind of forward-moving path dependency process. Everything is only grounded in the present tense, and an unknown future is generated by that present tense. It's not a present tense that we create in view of some future vision. And I'll come back to that in a minute. In the article itself, I go into some other issues and discuss also the intrinsic value of the means-ends correspondence, that is, in its enabling participants in social movements to already experience a liberated life as part of the process of the revolutionary struggle, at least as much as possible, this kind of intrinsic value of immediate gains for the workers' movement through things like, seizure of means of production, something that Kropotkin emphasizes in his articles for freedom in the end of the 19th century, as well as kind of current anarchist groups who emphasize the importance of what is sometimes referred to as a revolutionary lifestyle or the non-hierarchical lifestyle. So that's the first part, just kind of to insist on the anarchist story behind this correspondence of means and ends that is often written out of the history as if it's something that was just invented by the new left in the 60s. Now here's the second part, and this is an attempt to somewhat destabilize and question the logical soundness of the idea of prefiguration. Now, this is something that, of course, doesn't affect the value commitment to non-hierarchical relations, but I think there is a concern with the kind of temporal dimension, the time dimension that this concept evokes. The idea that we are creating something that is an embryonic form of future society, or that is an ingression of the future into the present, this kind of mentality. Because if we look at the sources of the term prefiguration, we find that, in fact, the context in which the idea of prefiguration came to feature in Western culture is Christian biblical interpretation. I'm going to skip this because I have a return to that. And this is strikingly absent from all accounts I've seen of prefigurative politics. And here I draw on Erich Auerbach, who is I'll come back to him later and tell his story, but he's kind of a literary theorist and so on from the 40s. And he has this seminal essay on the term figura, which looks at it from kind of ancient Roman poetry up to Dante. And he clarifies that, Christian biblical interpretation, since Paul the Apostle, it's already in the New Testament, approaches the Hebrew Bible as an Old Testament that has, in Paul's own words, a shadow of good things to come, Hebrews 10:1. So, stripped of its normative and national character, the Hebrew Bible's Christianized significance lies in its foreshadowing of the gospel, such that, I quote from de Lubac, Christ appears to us preceded by the shadows and the figures which he himself has cast on Jewish history. Cardinal de Lubac, one of the more important Catholic theologians. So for Paul the Apostle himself, he said that Adam was a figure of him that was to come, the first Adam. And the Greek word is typos, a type, which is often translated then in the Latin as figura. This is in Romans. The trials of the Israelites in the wilderness, he says, became examples. Again, typoi for us, Corinthians. And in the Vulgate, this is in figura facta sunt nostri, as a figure, a figuration. Auerbach identifies Tertullian as the earliest church father to develop kind of the sporadic Pauline references to figuration into a systematic, a theological approach. But from the 4th century on, the usage of the the word figura and the method of interpretation connected with it are fully developed. And this is basically the bog standard method of Christian biblical interpretation up till today. So Saint Jerome, who translated the Bible into Latin, here seen in a later, of course, figure, certainly uses this idea of prefiguration throughout his writings. In his epistle to Paulinus, which is titled De Studi Scripturarum, on the study of Scripture, the entire thing is about an exposition of how Christ is predestined and prefigured in the Law and the Prophets. And Deuteronomy is a prefiguration of evangelical law. Jonah calls the world to repent, his shipwreck prefiguring the passion of the Lord. And many other examples, using different terminology, like Joshua's lay of the land, describing the celestial spiritual kingdom of Jerusalem, or Esther, who in the figure of the church, in Ecclesia Tipo, uses a Greek root here, liberates her people from danger. Of course, the most prominent example of this idea of biblical prefiguration is the binding of Isaac, where Abraham is commanded to sacrifice his son, and this is seen precisely as an anticipation of the passion, where Abraham anticipates God, Isaac anticipates Jesus, and so on. Okay? So, and activists are often not aware of this because, you know, they're not religious, but this is really very, very regular procedure in biblical interpretation. Now, there are many other examples. I give a lot of examples from Augustine, for example, in The City of God, says that Cain, founder of the earthly city, signifies the Jews who killed Christ, the shepherd of men, prefigured by Abel, the shepherd of sheep. Or, you know, the kingdom of Saul was a shadow of a kingdom yet to come, and therefore David passed over the opportunity to slay Saul for the sake of what it prefigured. Propterirunt quod prefigurava. Okay? Now, I don't want to argue that just because prefiguration follows a certain logic in the context of Christian theology, that it has to follow the same logic in a political context. But I still think there are some conceptual anxieties here. That is, what exactly are anarchists supposed to be prefiguring with their current efforts? That is, what is the, to use a slightly bombastic term, what is the ontological status? What is the existent status of this, which is of what is said to be present in their modes of organization, culture, and so on? What exactly is the relationship between those ends? Where are those ends? Are they located in the future or not? I think that if we do correspond to this logic that does locate ends in the future, we are casting our own contemporary efforts as less than what they deserve to be. I'll give Auerbach's interpretation here. He's talking about the Christian interpretation, of course. His story is very interesting. Auerbach was a literary theorist in 1930s, 1940s Germany, and he was Jewish, so he had to escape the Nazis. He ends up in Istanbul without a library, with some notes, and from there he manages to publish these two amazing works of literary criticism, one called Mimesis, which is a study of imitation and figuration in literature, and this book, Scenes from the Drama of European Literature, in which this essay on figura appears. And it's all like, you know, it's as if he has a library in his head, because he can pull out all of these quotes and all of the, you know, he's such, so erudite, amazing. I think that there is a point here to be made about what kind of status we give the end that we desire. Because the logic, there is something about the logic of prefiguration that may, I'm not saying necessarily is, but may invest the idea of a future liberated society with more existence than it deserves. Now, my argument is that And the future liberated society, or the end, is not something that exists in the future. Okay? The end is something that exists in the present, in the imaginations and the desires of the activists who promote it. And we have to completely absorb this utopian dimension into the present if we don't want to imitate or mimic this logic whereby there is some end state which is promised, which is preordained, which is a given to us. And what we need to do is anticipate it. Instead, I propose that we need an attitude that says, that doesn't imagine something as existing that we need to imitate, but something that we are creating now, which may or may not lead somewhere. So going back to something that's much closer to Emma Goldman's more linear logic rather than this loop logic. So I think that really the notion of prefiguration has something really suspiciously theological woven into it, which may require us really to abandon the term and revise our understanding of the significance of this means-ends correspondence. So I think that we should avoid a logic whereby a future post-revolutionary state of affairs somehow radiates backwards into contemporary events. The problem is that this logic doesn't represent neither the kind of instrumental preventative logic of non-hierarchical politics nor the intrinsic value of inhabiting liberated relations. It's based on quite a different world of meaning. To assert that the logic of a revolutionary project is prefigurative is necessarily to argue that it points in some way towards a future state of affairs which, however still anticipated, is seen as having an existence in its own right. But anarchists have consistently distanced themselves from a position like this. And there's an issue with, this is an example of exactly this logic. Now, of course, this isn't actually Gerard Winstanley, right? This is the actor in a movie about Winstanley, which is a great movie, by the way. It's shot in black and white as if it's like an old movie, but many of you may be familiar with this. Now, this is from one of Winstanley's most famous pamphlets, the True Liberator Standard, Vance, and he has... most of Winstanley's works, if you look at them, are kind of pure theology, right? But it appears there too. And here is exactly an example of a revolutionary prefigurative logic that is still entirely cast in religious terms. Okay? Winstanley thinks that he and the diggers are bringing on the second coming with what they're doing. Okay? The entire digger project for Winstanley is wrapped up in the fulfillment of a promise, in the notion that he and his comrades are essentially actors in a script that has been written, from above in anticipation of end times. And notice this kind of the idea of the anti-type. What is the anti-type? The anti-type is that which is prefigured, right? So figura in Latin, but typos in Greek. So he sees the spiritual Israel, i.e. the church or his own group, right, as something that was prefigured in the Bible. So you have the kind of three moments, right? The Old Testament, the New Testament, which it prefigures, and the end times, which are again prefigured. And so Winstanley conceptualizes what he's doing as happening exactly in that context. Now, where's the link exactly between this Christian millenarianism and revolutionary action? Well, unsurprisingly, it's a secularized version of this millenarian theology, which comes in the form of the more, let's say, determinist versions of Marxism. And this is where I'll come back to my previous link here. the Russian Revolution, which I talked about. This is actually an even earlier example of the logic of prefiguration. This is André Gortz. André Gortz is a French Marxist, which later in the 80s became famous as one of the first Marxists to incorporate environmentalist concerns. But this is what he's writing in 1968, in November. This is from a piece published in the New Left Review called The Way Forward. It's coming out in the winter following the events of May 68, right? And what's striking about this is the way in which Gortz is able to use the term prefiguration squarely within this kind of orthodox Marxist framework of vanguardism and the seizure of state power, right? I guess you're reading this quote. Gortz, I mean, in the article, what's interesting is that he kind of employs familiar stereotypes. He calls upon the left to resist what I quote, the temptation to pose the problem of how to overthrow the bourgeois state in anarcho-syndicalist terms, relying on mass spontaneity, seeing insurrection as the royal road to revolution, the theory of all or nothing, according to which the revolution must be a quasi-instantaneous act, and until the great day there is nothing much to be done apart from agitation and propaganda. Now, while some of that may still be gleaned from Bakunin's attitude, you know, following the Paris Commune, I think there are parts in Bakunin's writing where he does seem to be anticipating this kind of simultaneous universal uprising, I don't think this is a fair characterization of anarchism. But what's interesting is that instead he proposes what he calls a Guevarist strategy, named after Che Guevara, whereby, and I'm quoting, the unifying political perspective of a revolutionary movement cannot be the immediate construction of socialism and of communism, that is, a post-revolutionary society, can only be that of a revolutionary transformation of the present society by means of a range of intermediary objectives which are intended to make evident the necessity for the transition to socialism, to prefigure it in certain concrete aspects without necessarily taking socialism as the explicit short-term aim. Now, notice this is the exact opposite of what anarchists mean by prefiguration today, right? Rather than a post-revolutionary society, the Vanguard Party prefigures the proletarian state and reflects for the working class its capacity to be a ruling class. This is again, a quote. Far from serving as a model of liberation, the party's, quote, central organs, by their cohesion and capacity for political analysis, will prefigure the central power of the transitional period. Now, it should be pretty striking for practitioners of prefigurative politics in their own eyes today to realize that the term itself has a pedigree so distant from the content that they associate with it. But I'd argue that there is something more authentic in Gortz's use of prefiguration, in fact, than in the loose way that anarchists use it, because his framework maintains this millenarian logic of a promised future state, of modeling something that is given in advance. However, anarchists enact forms of sociality, cooperation, and non-ownership, etc., which are neither argued to somehow already exist in a future point in time, nor to have any definitive shape or blueprint beyond the experimental. So if this object which is supposed to be prefigured is neither guaranteed nor definite, if the movement itself rejects detailed blueprints and thick accounts of desired social institutions and so on, if indeed all that is being said usually about anti-hierarchical practices proceeds by way of negation, right, of authority, of patriarchy, of racism, proprietarianism, heteronormativity, speciesism, and so on, while the positive aspects are left to the play of experimentation, expected to be as diverse as a thousand flowers, then what exactly is being prefigured? My answer would be nothing. attempting to undo in the movement itself those features that would derail a revolution does not, for me, carry any correspondence with a future society. Ends and goals are not located, once again, in the future, but only in the will and consciousness of present tense, existing, breathing individuals. As long as ends remain conceived in terms of a future state that is somehow given, anarchists risk slipping into the secularized millenarian logic which Marxists like Gortz have inherited from the Christian point of view. The point is not that practices are undertaken because they correspond with some desired social situation, but because they express values that already exist for the participants. The spaces of liberation that are achieved through processes of political struggle should receive their value not through their correspondence to a non-existing future, but solely for the difference they make in the lives of empirical individuals, as well as the degree to which they instrumentally promote revolutionary ends. So without a unitary or otherwise positive and substantive design for a post-revolutionary society, without a promised end state, I think the idea of prefiguration, at least in its temporal logic, must lose a lot of its meaning, and we need to question its place in our political language. All right, so that was the presentation, and now I'm really happy to open this up to any discussion, questions. It doesn't have to be a back and forth. Please feel free to talk to one another and all that good stuff. Self-facilitated. I think there are few enough of us. There's usually a clock on the bottom of this, but if I do this, then we have 15 minutes.
Not very much. I'm not sure where the anarchist society is if it's not in the future. Yes, there's no blueprint, but we know that we don't have electoral representation, we don't have gender inequalities, we don't have centralised decision making. There are key things, otherwise it's not the anarchist society. The point is that what you decide to do in a non-hierarchical way, that's up to you and the community that you live in. So where that could exist has to be in the future. It can't be now. The way that we get there can't just be to live in that kind of way amongst ourselves now and suddenly it happens, because we've got all these other external forces like capitalism, militarism, etc., hierarchical forces, and also patriarchy and other forces that are maybe not just to do with capitalism.
Mm-hmm.
So it has to be in the future, and to me, it can only happen by revolution. And the point of prefiguration is that you live as much as you can in an anarchist way now, so that revolution can be as brief, as effective and as bloodless as possible, because you've already kind of made a really good case that we don't need these things in order to live in this way. But I don't see us having an anarchist society now, so where is it?
Well, I mean, my answer is that it's nowhere. It does not exist. I don't think its existence in the future is in any way guaranteed or given either. I might draw your attention to the fact that, you know, when you characterize these anarchist societies, it was all about what it doesn't have, right? So we do tend to have this kind of negative characterization. And so really this might be a point the point of this entire kind of presentation might be too subtle to really be worth it. But it seems to me that there are two ways to think about a revolutionary project in the large scale. One is as some future reality that has some substance, some existence, and that we are trying to anticipate. And the other is current forms of life that are practiced among people, which sometimes, you know, in an explicitly revolutionary mindset, sometimes not, try to kind of find their way, to to grow as against all these things that are encroaching on it. You know, and I'm much more kind of, I'm pointing towards the kind of thing that was, you know, that's maybe captured in David Goodway's idea of seeds beneath the snow, you know, or in Colin Ward's notion of this kind of everyday anarchism that people might fall into in a regular way. And so I'm talking about a currently existing form of life that, you know, is attached to revolutionary efforts in order to defend itself and expand itself, but it's something that already has a concrete existence in the here and now, rather than drawing primarily from the reference to a future point. I don't know if that sharpens that distinction better, but maybe. Okay, so we had one and two and three. How about that?
A kind of complementary way that I've been thinking about anarchist revolution and like being an anarchist. The idea that like when you interact with people in an anarchist way, in a like non-hierarchical way, you create a kind of anarchist bubble, and within that bubble, if it's like internally consistent, like anarchism is already taking place. The problem is that, you know, that bubble, wherever it is, maybe it's like a meeting or like a social centre or a gathering or something. The problem is that bubble, like it's limited, it's only like a minority amount of people taking part in it or whatever. But what I'd emphasise is that within that bubble, anarchism already exists. The only problem is that it's limited to the point of like being an anarchist, trying to bring about anarchy, I think, is a matter of attempting to expand that bubble to the point where enough people get involved with it that what you call a revolution actually occurs. But what I'd emphasise is that the moment of revolution, it's not anything fundamentally different taking place in terms of our actions and our interactions with each other. The moment of revolution is just the moment where there's a critical mass of engagement with those kinds of ways of interacting with each other. And the forms of interaction are no different, they just become more popular. So that's when the bubble kind of becomes mainstream. That's the way I think about it.
We still have the question of repression in there, you know, because it's difficult to imagine a peaceful expansion. So. But
yeah, of course. Like that, there's, you know, that's really just like the basics. Like there's so much that you have to think about in terms of, you know, if you do try to expand the bubble, then the state will recognise that its influence is being reduced, and then you will be repressed. But,
yeah, I can work on that. Yeah. I mean, I really disagree. The idea that in a social centre or even just like you and I talking to each other or something, that there's anarchism there. There's so much else. There's the other baggage that we come with, like the idea that we would have a conversation with gender equal, or we would have a conversation, and you know, other like I talk too much, for example, I might talk into the ground. You know, that's not anarchism. So even amongst anarchists, we can't practice anarchism. It's very, very difficult to do, and I think we have to structure it out, really actively structure it out, and that is a difficult relationship.
Yeah, if I can respond, I totally agree, I think. I don't think it's just anarchism because we call it anarchism. It's only anarchism if you really aren't acting on a hierarchical basis. Like even if you think that you're in an anarchist bubble, you're being anarchist. Like you say, we always have to be wary of the fact that we might be oppressing each other and like reinforcing oppressive structures. But I think that's more a message of caution in terms of how we interact with each other, rather than, I don't think it rejects prefiguratism. It's just like, you have to take it really seriously, like, the sense in which we do attempt to prefigure, like, the kind of world that we want to see.
And let's maybe give a chance to, one, two, three others, and we've got about 8 minutes. So I think there was, whatever.
Oh, just going to say, I guess between the two points, I'm interested in, What you didn't mention, what I thought perhaps you were going to say, judging by your first slide, which was that the way in which, if we like, mainstream oppositional politics has co-opted configuration by the extreme proliferation of this phrase, be the change you want to see. You know, we started seeing that phrase increasingly occur about 10 years ago, and now pretty much you kind of can't move for it. But be the change you want to see. You know, so the idea is, and this is perhaps, you know, where I absolutely agree with you, is that what you have when you have that phrase and you think, well, what I really want, you know, is a world completely free of pesticides, and I want a world where actually animals aren't being killed. So what I'm going to do is I'm going to be the change I want to see, and when I go into Starbucks, I'm going to ask for organic coffee.
Right.
Because what is embodied in that phrase, be the change you want to see, is a kind of invisible first part of the sentence, which is, it is sufficient.
Sure.
Change
and
like that's all I need.
And that being the change means is an individual project
exactly.
that is rooted through consumerism, and so on.
And all of the things that Zizek, you know, talks about when he says, okay, consumerism co-opts our opposition to it by making us pay a little 5p extra for organic coffee, and then we go away with a clear conscience.
Yeah, they sell it back.
So and at the end, fantastic, and I'm feeling optimistic because. Don't we all? I lie in bed at night. Am I ever going to live in a society that's free from all of the things that I hate? Or am I going to die a disappointed man? And you know what? I'm probably going to die a disappointed man because that's the way it is. But okay, you offer me a future where that's okay because I can live it and I can be it now, and it offers me that taste of liberation that belongs to my present and I can inhabit it, and that's fine. But that's not enough.
No.
You know, and I agree with you. We've got to do everything else as well as that. We can have those bubbles and we can be in those spaces, but we need to be more than that, and we need to bring it to the other people who, you know, it's not all right because they're dying. You know, they don't have that great moment that, you know, it's okay, I'll buy organic coffee, because they're being ground up by the teeth and the cogs of capitalism.
Absolutely.
So we need to do that, but we need to do more too.
Okay, 1 minute.
I was just going to ask, I'm quite new to these ideas myself, so... Was there kind of like a distinction between ontology and epistemology? So is the prefigurative idea something like an epistemological kind of endpoint?
I think that, well,
like sort of
if we want to introduce those terms, then I'd say that I think that this presentation deals with the ontological status of ends. Do we imagine them to have some kind of existence outside of or future to their present day attempts? Epistemology, I mean, I guess epistemology comes in if we look at the theological interpretation side of it, but it's not something I've thought through very well so until now. Okay, I see 1 and 2, and 3, 4, and I think that's all we have time for.
Well, if you're talking properly, I'm from the Council Estate, 7th Generation Sheffield. First thing I'd say is, get your own coffee. Managers don't want to work in your coffee shop. I run Unions Community for Sheffield. I sit on Religious Hall. Sheffield there, opposite Bishop Sheffield, and all sorts of people. I'm not even religious. I've only just learned that word prefiguration yesterday.
Right.
And there's another word, intersectionality, what I learned last week.
All right.
I was sat with a load of feminists at the time, only me. And what I've done is I've been building up and making links all from Sheffield with Muslim sisters, we've got PhDs down to working class lasses. All the hijabs on, niqabs on, playing chess with them to try and learn about Quran so that they could. I taught them chess so they could teach me about Quran and stuff. And what I've realised is we've got lots of bonds between us. But when we talk about this anarchy, I think I see that. That's like modern utopianism, isn't it? I know Fabian states in London, Sheffield, believe it or not, about most people want to teach me. And what I've noticed is there's no end game. There isn't an end game. I think it's how we actually live. And from what I took about anarchy, I knock about the class war and stuff and all that. But I think what I take from anarchy is it's about questioning authority all the time. Always question, why are you a governor? Why are you a social worker telling my kids what to do? Why, you know, these things. I think that's what we need to do. We just need to break that apart. And I think I see what you mean by it's not predestined. There's no destiny.
Mm-hmm.
We're not predestined. It's not a Greek play. Yeah, we're not got Zeus, Weeds, Bloody Abbots. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
I think we're just here now and we have to deal with it. That, does that make sense?
Yeah.
I think what I was going to say is just maybe another version of that, but just that the what I understand to be the problem with prefiguration as a version of being the change is that it's not just that it's sort of saying the future already exists and we've just built to it, but it's also about the sanctity of the blueprint,
mm-hmm.
right? And that kind of comes with the theological implications. So rather than enacting the world we want to bring into being in an experimental way, moment by moment, figuring it out as we go, we have this sense that we already know exactly what we want and we're just going to mirror it. And that's not free, right? It's that takes away the sense that the world, if we get the world we want, it will probably be something we can't now imagine.
Well, it's our grandchildren who made it.
Yeah, no, I mean, that we shouldn't assume that our imagination can
That's
set
right.
out the world
mm-hmm.
that we need to
mm-hmm.
create.
Yeah.
We don't know enough.
Okay.
Well, I was going to say, this typifies the bourgeois intellectualism of a non-movement in this country.
Mm.
We've had a social attack on the poor, the weak, the disabled. Mm. The fascists are marching on the street every fucking day now,
mm.
and we get this stuff. This intellectual crap. Look at Martin Light's latest podcast, but more about 3 weeks ago. He said the first thing anarchists should do is get rid of the academics,
mm-hmm.
get closed, double into universities. We don't want intersectionality. We don't want all these very hard concepts,
right.
which I'm intelligent and I'm struggling with them. These things are instead of a working class social revolution. These things are for white people, for middle class people, put on stuff, and they are meaningless. While we're sitting here, you know, people are maybe redundant. In other countries, people take up arms, like the sisters, our comrades in Kurdistan. They're fighting for change on the battlefield. And this stuff has no emotional resonance. It's your academics with PhDs talking garbage. And you talk that garbage while capitalism expands, while fascism increases, where our daily freedom are constantly taken away from us. So what will happen is, throughout the world, there will be a social interaction. It's already happening throughout the world, from Greece to Kurdistan. But the white middle classes of England and America are irrelevant to that struggle. I would say that your irrelevance is so strong. The real ideas of anarchism, the ideas of comradeship, of solidarity, of class struggle, of fighting hierarchy. It's nothing to do with the stuff you get from universities.
Mm-hmm.
This university stuff to me is counter-revolutionary. It just means white middle class people can do this for a few years before they get a job in the city.
What? Okay. I'm going to permit myself just to say that I think that there isn't necessarily a contradiction between speaking, among anarchists about perhaps slightly more advanced thinking about our own project that sometimes requires us to be a bit more abstract and engaging in very concrete politics. I mean, this isn't instead, last week I was helping organize Food Not Bombs in Leicester. I think that, if it's meaningless to you and if you don't feel that it contributes anything to your thinking, then that's fine. I thought that, when I tried to think in a bit more depth about the kind of things that I'm trying to do as a I don't want to be pretentious and say as a revolutionary or whatever, but the kind of things I'm trying to do and the kind of mentality that I bring to it, then I think that I think that it might be useful for me to be able to use my privilege and access to ideas in order to elaborate some things that maybe people hadn't thought about before, and God makes them go. Then that might be interesting.
This is the dominant philosophy of Western anarchism.
And
that's what it's doing.
Well, you know, I mean, I'm sorry that this kind of frills your feathers, but all I have to say is that I don't think it has to come instead, and I think that it's a bit also. I think there's something a bit kind of deprecative about saying that whatever working class people or real activists can't relate to abstract or complex ideas, and that that's something that belongs in academia and has to be professionalized.
But it has.
And the whole point of this talk is to try and break down those boundaries. I mean, I don't know. I'm on a whatever, not a 0 hour, but a temporary contract. I'm a union member. I'm trying to do everything. I mean, I don't know. I could be working in a bomb factory. I think it's a bit better.
No, I'm not. I'm talking about the philosophy and ideology of a non-class struggle, non-populist, non-proletarian.
Yeah, but look, I come from a settler colonial society. Okay, the British categories of class struggle are not relevant in Israel and Palestine, for example. Right?
Well,
I don't think. I think that imagining that, you know, class structures or cultures of resistance everywhere have to mirror the tradition, illustrious as it is, of British working class resistance is, again, it's a bit culturally imperialist.
Resistance has to go a lot further than it has done.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, how many people can you get in the streets?
Well, here now.
Mm.
About 1,000.
Well, that's good.
But I'm aware that there was another person who wanted to say something, and I skipped over him. And people are waiting for the next talk as well.
You know, you're 5 minutes over.
I know. So maybe, but I'm happy to stay behind and chat with anybody about anything.